draws Latinx and immigrants as a political prop. He needs to deliver. We expect him to do, in his first 100 days, a moratorium on all deportations. And that doesn't mean keeping people sitting in detention while deportations don't happen. He needs to create a process to release absolutely every one of the detention centers, shut down all detention centers, not only the private ones, begin a process for abolishing ICE, so we can also go into a process of healing, which means reparations for absolutely everybody that's been in detention and has been suffering the cruelty of ICE and ICE detention.
We want to thank you both for joining us. And, of course, we're going to continue to cover this issue. Maru Mora Villalpando and Manuel Obrego are with the immigrant rights group La Resistencia in Seattle, Washington. And a happy birthday to our Democracy Now! Co-news director, Renee Feltz. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermin Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Torina Nandura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Stay safe. Wear a mask. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives you a little back in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies. Available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. And thanks.
There's so much that we need to share, so send a smile and show you care.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the first COVID-19 vaccinations were administered in three hospitals across Oregon today. Klamath Falls Police Department has arrested one of its own detectives after involvement in a Black Friday car crash, and Congress may be coming to agreement on new stimulus relief. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 16th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 1,129 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 96,092. Oregon health officials also reported a striking 54 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 1,214. The first COVID-19 vaccines were administered at three hospitals in Oregon today. The event was live-streamed as part of Governor Kate Brown's press briefing. The vaccines were administered at Legacy Health and Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, as well as at St. Alphonsus in Ontario near the Idaho border. Brown cautioned in her press briefing that Oregonians still need to continue wearing masks, safely distancing, and staying home when sick. Oregon is expected to receive a total of 100,000 vaccines by the end of December, but no word on what is to be expected in the new year. Patrick Allen is the director of the Oregon Health Authority. They said that the OHA will prioritize vaccinating people who are most at risk. Phase one of the plan focuses on vaccinating healthcare workers, nursing home residents, staff, and essential workers, and then people who are over the age of 65, as well as folks with underlying conditions. Governor Brown plans to convene a vaccine advisory team that will help make decisions about which essential workers receive the vaccine first. More than 16 million people in the U.S. have been infected with the coronavirus. Over the past week, there has been an average of 206,000 cases per day, which is an increase of 28% from the average 2 weeks earlier. The country has already reached a terrible milestone, with the death toll surpassing 300,000 people in just the U.S. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened over 63 million people, with currently more than 500,000 cases being reported each day on average. At least 1.6 million people have died. Six additional Oregon counties were elevated to the state's extreme risk category yesterday, meaning all of the Oregon coast is now under the highest risk guidelines. Governor Brown announced yesterday that the counties of Tillamook, Benton, Clatsop, Lincoln, Coos, and Curry were to be added to the extreme risk level in the state's most recent two-week monitoring window. State leaders adopted county-level risk categories last month in an attempt to better tailor COVID restrictions to fit individual county needs as the virus began to surge nationwide. As of yesterday's announcement, 29 of Oregon's 36 counties are categorized as extreme risk. Counties under extreme risk guidelines must halt all indoor dining, gym services, and theater showings. Religious services will be capped at 25% capacity or 100 people, whichever is smaller. The state continues to see cases rise and hospitals fill as the first doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine landed this week. Yesterday was the deadliest day on record in Oregon since the pandemic began. The Oregon Health Authority reported 54 COVID-related deaths yesterday, jumping past the old record of 36 deaths set last Tuesday. Enhanced safety measures will begin on Friday for those counties under the new risk categories. The next assignments for risk level will take place on January 1st. The Klamath Falls Police Department announced the arrest of one of its own detectives on Tuesday after investigations revealed he caused a Black Friday car crash while under the influence of illicit drugs. Detective Thomas Reif was on duty in his unmarked assigned police vehicle at the time of the crash. He was found unresponsive at the scene and taken to a local hospital where he was stabilized and later released. There were no other injuries connected to the crash. An internal affairs investigation into Reif's conduct on December 1st found multiple alleged policy violations, and Reif resigned rather than wait for termination. The Oregon State Police were tasked with the criminal investigation into the crash. Over the past weekend, evidence processed by the state police revealed Reif was under the influence of fentanyl, a Schedule I synthetic opioid, at the time of the crash. State police say there is probable cause Reif obtained the drug from evidence in an unrelated case. He was arrested Tuesday on a series of impaired driving, official misconduct, and controlled substance charges. According to the Mail Tribune, Reif was no longer in custody later in the afternoon. The Klamath Falls Police Department said it was, quote, deeply embarrassed and disappointed with Mr. Reef's conduct in a statement that was released on Facebook yesterday. Mr. Reif is currently under review by the Department of Safety Standards and Training to determine whether he is still qualified to serve as law enforcement elsewhere in the state. The effects of the COVID-19 pandemic are hurting families in many different ways, including loss of health insurance, not being able to put food on the table, and feelings of hopelessness. For more on the story, we go to Eric Tegedoff with the Oregon News Service.
The effects of COVID-19 are squeezing many families in Oregon, and a new report examines the ways they are struggling. According to the Annie E. Casey Foundation, 1 in 8 Oregon families is having a hard time putting food on the table, 1 in 9 doesn't have health insurance, and nearly a quarter report feeling depressed or hopeless in the face of COVID-19. Jennifer Wagley, who heads the nonprofit group Our Children Oregon, says families are having to make tough financial choices.
When families are under pressure and when parents are struggling, we know that that pressure impacts the children.
The report also finds 13% of Oregon families say they aren't confident they'll be able to pay their rent or mortgage on time. Wagley notes that Oregon's eviction moratorium expires at year's end. She hopes the state will extend it into the new year. Leslie Bossier with the Casey Foundation says the pandemic has laid bare and exacerbated racial and ethnic inequities across the country. She says Black, Latino, and Native communities in particular have been hard hit.
If you look at food security, 14% of households reported that they didn't have enough food to eat. When you compare that to African Americans, it's 23%, so almost double, and 19% for Latinos, compared to 9% for Asians and 10% for whites.
The report recommends policymakers make racial and ethnic equity a top priority in responding to the pandemic. It suggests financial support for families and more equitable funding for education. Wagley says that protecting children from homelessness is important.
That's true before a pandemic, that every child needs a stable, quality, affordable house. But right now, in the middle of this ongoing pandemic, children need shelter more than ever.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
5 history-making Black women have been selected as finalists by a committee of students, educators, and committee members to be the new name of Portland's Wilson High School. The school is currently named after President Woodrow Wilson, who instituted segregation in federal government agencies and was an ally of the Ku Klux Klan. 2 of the 5 finalists for the school name are Oregonians. Mercedes Diaz was the first Black woman to practice law in Oregon, beginning in 1960. She was also the first Black woman to be elected a county circuit judge and to serve as a district court judge in the state. Beatrice Moreau Kennedy was a co-founder and the first vice president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP. Kennedy also served as editor of The Advocate, Oregon's largest Black newspaper in the early decades of the 20th century. The other 3 finalists are Ida B. Wells, Sojourner Truth, and Harriet Wilson. Ida B. Wells was born into slavery in 1863. Wells was a co-founder of the NAACP and was widely recognized for her work as an investigative journalist, including reports on lynchings in the South. Sojourner Truth is best known for her 1851 speech, "Ain't I a Woman?" Truth recruited soldiers for the Union during the Civil War and fought for abolition and civil rights. And Harriet Wilson wrote the first novel by a Black person to be published in the U.S., though it was published anonymously in 1859. Madison High School, named after President James Madison, will also be renamed. Congressional leaders said on Wednesday that they are nearing an agreement on the $900 billion economic relief package that should be completed by the end of this week. The new COVID relief package will likely include another round of direct payments to U.S. citizens, which is expected to be a one-time payment of between $600 and $700. Nearly 8 million people have fallen below the poverty line since just this summer. An earlier version of the package did not include the checks to individuals, but strong pressure from House progressives has led to its addition in the most recent bill. The bill also includes a new round of funding for the Paycheck Protection Program, which provides funds for large corporations and has been heavily criticized by policy experts. Some things are likely to be left out, like state and local funding, as well as an earlier proposed liability shield for employers. Steven Rosenthal is a tax expert with the Tax Policy Center. He estimates that the PPP deduction could reduce the taxes of the highest income taxpayers by at least $100 billion without benefiting workers or the unemployed. The relief package likely won't be passed this week, as it still has to clear the Senate, which has refused to consider any relief bills since March. The federal government announced on Wednesday that even though the population of monarch butterflies has plummeted, the species will not be listed as endangered due to funding issues. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
The feds announced Tuesday that the monarch butterfly will not be listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act for at least a few more years, even though its populations have plummeted. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says the monarch meets the criteria for listing, but limited resources mean other species will be listed first. Preliminary data from the annual Thanksgiving count of monarchs that overwinter on the California coast showed only 2,000 to 3,000 individuals. UC Davis professor Dr. Arthur Shapiro says that number should be orders of magnitude higher.
The entire California population has not exceeded 30,000 for the last 2 winters, and it looks like this year will be even worse. They should be more like 20 or 30 million.
The reasons for the decline of this iconic orange and black butterfly are still being studied, but the culprits include losing habitat to development, pesticides, and climate change. In addition, proliferation of parasite-prone non-native milkweeds in coastal areas may be leading the butterflies to breed early in the winter instead of the spring. Dr. Cheryl Schultz, a biology professor at Washington State University, Vancouver, was part of a team predicting 3 years ago that if the monarch population dropped below 30,000, the species could spiral past the extinction threshold, the point at which there are too few individuals to keep it going. However, Schultz remains hopeful the species can be saved.
With people working together and using the science, I think there's incredible promise and resiliency of the monarch populations to turn them around.
For now, the monarch will remain a candidate species to be listed in the future as threatened. The Endangered Species Coalition is asking butterflies enthusiasts to take a stand and call for protections for the monarch and other pollinators. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Tom Bray, who will be starring as Charles Dickens in a live-streamed version of A Christmas Carol this Saturday. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be also rainy with a high of 49. Today in history in 2013, disability rights activist and writer Marta Russell died. Her political views, which she described as, quote, left, not liberal, informed her writing on various topics like healthcare, poverty, prison, and ableism. The quote of the day is from Marta Russell's 2001 piece about the prison industrial complex. Russell wrote, quote, in 21st century America, the prison industrial complex is a multi-billion dollar capitalist juggernaut, devouring everything in its path. The United States spends far more on corrections than it spends on higher education. In 1995, prison populations topped 1 million. Since then, it's grown by more than 8% every year. Dr. Anthony Fauci spoke about the importance of vaccines during a virtual National Institutes of Health event on Tuesday. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci discussed COVID-19 research, clinical trials, and vaccines within American Indian and Alaska Native communities during a virtual National Institutes of Health event Tuesday. Fauci says vaccines are the safest intervention to stop infectious diseases.
As soon as a vaccine becomes available to you and the tribal nations, you should very seriously consider getting vaccinated. It is an extraordinarily effective form of prevention of this particular disease and other diseases for which we've been very successful with vaccines.
Fauci addressed concerns about vaccine trials in Native American populations and mistrust of the federal government.
We want to make sure that tribal nations are represented in the clinical trials, because when the trials are shown to be safe and effective, we want to be able to tell the people of the tribal nation that we have now proven that the vaccine is safe and effective in you and in your people, so that you can feel comfortable in taking it. If you don't get involved in the clinical trial, you will not feel comfortable that what we're giving you has been proven in a scientific way to be safe and effective.
As COVID-19 vaccines begin to reach tribal communities, Fauci says people should continue to practice public safety guidelines. The Navajo Nation, which has been hit hard by COVID-19, seeing a spike in cases with uncontrolled spread in 77 communities, has now started to vaccinate healthcare workers. Roland Begay was among the first at the Chinle, Arizona healthcare facility to receive a vaccine this week. He spoke during a virtual town hall Tuesday, saying, getting the vaccine is a personal choice and the next step to take in the pandemic.
We make choices every day, regardless, and then modifying our behaviors. That's what came to mind. You know, taking care of yourself, just because, you know, this vaccine is here, you know, don't mean that we stop or put our masks away.
The Chinle facility was among Navajo Area Indian Health Service units to receive vaccines. The Navajo Area IHS was allocated 3,900 Pfizer vaccines for facilities in Arizona and New Mexico. Utah Navajo Health Systems are working with the state. As of Tuesday, the total number of positive cases for the Navajo Nation reached more than 19,900. Pressure continues across Indian country for the Biden-Harris transition team to name New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland Secretary of the Department of the Interior as President-elect Joe Biden announces picks for his cabinet. Tribal leaders, directors of Native organizations, and even Hollywood stars are urging Biden to choose Haaland to lead the agency as an indigenous person. New Mexico U.S. Senator Tom Udall is said to be a top contender. In a press call Tuesday, the retiring senator was tight-lipped about any conversations he's had with the transition team. Here's what he had to say when asked what his message would be to Indian country if named to lead the Interior Department.
The tribal leaders, they've known me for my entire elected career and even before that. And I'm just very encouraged by how many of them are speaking up and telling the Biden transition who would be a good Interior Secretary. I'm just very encouraged. And these are my friends, and I've worked with them a long time, and I'm very, very close to New Mexico's 23 tribes and those tribal leaders.
Udall says right now he's continuing to advocate and fight for tribes, including for resources for COVID-19 as he finishes his service in the U.S. Senate. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Trump administration continued its series of post-election federal executions on Friday with the killing of Alfred Bourgeois, age 56. That was the second execution since Trump's election loss. The first death was of Brandon Bernard on Thursday of last week. Three more executions are planned for January: Lisa Montgomery on January 12th, Corey Johnson on January 14th, and Dustin Higgs on January 15th. Four of the five people in this spate of federal executions are Black men. Demographic studies have shown that Black men receive harsher penalties for the same crimes when compared to white men. The fifth person to be executed is a woman. Montgomery will be the first woman to be executed in over 70 years. The last time a lame duck president presided over an execution was Grover Cleveland in 1889 in the federal execution of Richard Smith, a member of the Choctaw Nation. President-elect Joe Biden rallied in Georgia on Tuesday for Democratic Senate candidates a day after winning the Electoral College. With more on the story, it's Laura Rosbrow-Tellum with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
While Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue watch Mitch McConnell burn our economy down, and they stand behind him holding the matches, we need to send our firefighters, our first responders. We are sending John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock to D.C. to save America.
That's Stacey Abrams opening a rally yesterday for Georgia's Democratic senatorial candidates, John Ossoff and Reverend Raphael Warnock. The runoff election on January 5th will decide control of the Senate. President-elect Joe Biden also showed up a day after the Electoral College confirmed his victory. Biden urged Georgians to cast their ballots again.
One of the three reasons I was running to restore the soul of America, well, electing people of character is how you restore the soul of America. People like John and Raphael, they know public service isn't about them, it's about you.
Here's Reverend Raphael Warnock, senior pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, who's running against Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler.
I'm ready to stand up for affordable health care. Stand up for a livable wage. Stand up for voting rights and equal rights in this defining moment in American history. Put your shoes on. Let's get it done.
Nearly 170,000 Georgia voters showed up to the polls on Monday, the first day of early voting for the Senate runoff elections. That's tens of thousands more ballots than the first day of early in-person voting for the November general election. Very unusual for a runoff election, where voting usually drops. But it'll be hard for both Democratic candidates to win. Republican Senator David Perdue beat John Ossoff by close to 2% in November, with 49.7% of the vote, just shy of the 50% needed to avoid a runoff. Both of Georgia senators supported Texas's lawsuit last week, trying to overturn the election in battleground states like Georgia. But an increasing number of Republican senators are congratulating Biden. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky acknowledged Biden's win yesterday on the Senate floor, more than a month after the election was overwhelmingly called for Biden.
I want to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden. The President-elect is no stranger to the Senate. He's devoted himself to public service for many years. I also want to congratulate the Vice President-elect, our colleague from California, Senator Harris. Beyond our differences, all Americans can take pride that our nation has a female Vice President-elect for the very first time.
McConnell said that while many millions of Americans would have wanted the election to turn out differently, the Electoral College had spoken, Afterwards, McConnell urged fellow Republicans during a private call not to join House members challenging election results during the congressional ratification of the vote on January 6th. President-elect Biden chose Democratic primary opponent Pete Buttigieg to be his transportation secretary nominee. If the Senate confirms Buttigieg, he would be the first openly gay person to be a cabinet secretary. And former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm is rumored to be Biden's pick to lead the Energy Department. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosprout-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
Farming like indigenous people did could help bolster Hawaii's food supply, as the island is heavily reliant on imports. Dr. Anthony Lazowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hawaii imports more than 85% of its food. So if extreme weather disrupts shipping, it could have serious consequences for the state.
You just kind of grow up knowing that we only have like a week of food on the shelves. And if the barge doesn't come, you know, we're in big trouble.
That's Natalie Kurashima. While a PhD student at the University of Hawaii, she studied whether indigenous farming methods could help reduce this food insecurity, especially as the climate changes.
I always was wondering, how can we learn from our Ike Kupuna, our ancestral knowledge, to address Hawaii's sustainability issues today?
She says before colonization, indigenous farmers grew crops in areas that people today would not. They farmed terraced land that had to be flooded during cultivation and grew root vegetables under banana and coconut trees. Those methods were productive. Kurashima's study suggests that they could have produced enough food for 86% of Hawaii's current population. So if implemented today, indigenous farming methods could make Hawaii's food system more resilient to extreme weather and help the state sustain itself in the future as it did in the past. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael won't be getting the vaccine for Christmas this year.
The vaccine is here, and the shoving in line is fiercer than the competition for PlayStation 5s. Lobbyists say they're essential personnel. Major League Baseball wants their young, very healthy players inoculated early. While the Senate won't allot money to cash-strapped states to distribute and deliver the vaccines, but will give large businesses immunity from not protecting their workers. What's more American than that? Maybe hijacking vaccine shipments and auctioning doses on eBay. On the brighter side, Putin and McConnell have acknowledged Biden's victory, so it must be true. While Uncle Joe, he's a-moving kind of slow, is bringing back the old gang from the Obama and Clinton administrations to ensure us citizens a kinder and gentler oligarchy. Not a new year, just a recycled one, but let's celebrate the Messiah vaccine by ordering even more plastic from Amazon, because Bezos needs to be a trillionaire, and there's nowhere else left to shop. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 16th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law, Ken Jones, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, Suzanne Potter, Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be interviewing Tom Bray, who will be starring as Charles Dickens in a live-streamed version of A Christmas Carol this Saturday.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The holidays are here, and along with it, our own holiday traditions.
For many of us, the season isn't complete without attending a performance of the Nutcracker or Handel's Messiah or any of the other many Christmas-themed in-person events. This season, many of those events have been canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but fortunately, a few are going online, giving us the chance to view them from the comfort and safety of our own homes. One of those traditions here in Portland is the long-running one-man show, A Christmas Carol, a Victorian reading, with actor, writer, artist, and teacher Tom Bray in the role of Charles Dickens. Tom recreates the public readings of A Christmas Carol that Dickens himself performed from 1849 until his death in 1870. This year, Tom is moving the show from stage to screens, live streaming his performance directly to you this Saturday, December 19th at 7 p.m. The performance will also be available to view on demand up until the day after Christmas. We're fortunate to have Tom with us to talk more about the show, Dickens' own readings of A Christmas Carol, and the enduring appeal of the story itself. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tom, I want to start out with a little bit about your background. It's such an impressive list of credits as an actor, a screenwriter, and a teacher.
Well, yeah, I guess I discovered in high school when I was dragged in from a hallway by my band teacher that I had a stage bug, and I found my calling. I was fortunate enough to know what I wanted to do from ninth grade on, and so I started acting and moved right out of college on Long Island to New York City, and from there to Hollywood, and I've never kind of looked back. It's been a great career, or careers, I should say.
No, there's a whole lot we could talk about that, but I wanted to get right to your show, A Christmas Carol. Dickens first published the book itself, December 19th, 1843. It was an immediate success. Apparently, the first edition sold out in less than a week by Christmas Eve. Why did Dickens himself start reading it to an audience rather than just relying on the print version?
Well, Dickens was an actor, an amateur actor, and by all accounts, a really, really good amateur actor. One of the leading performers of his day, Charles Macready, said that Dickens was one of the best actors he had ever seen. And so Dickens had been known to do lots of amateur theatrics. He would, you know, stage shows in his own home, and he would also do them for charity. So he was primed to be an actor. He often said that if he hadn't been a writer, he probably would have become an actor. And in fact, he had auditioned for some parts early on and was turned down because he had a cold when he auditioned. So, you know, all of literary history might have changed if Charles Dickens had become an actor. But he started reading this. He first read his Christmas stories for a private audience, kind of friends around the fire. And they were extremely well received. And so he got this idea that maybe he should start giving public readings. And all his advisors said, no, this would be, you know, it's kind of gauche for you to be, you know, a famous writer out there performing for money. So he decided to do them as charity events. And that's what he did. So his first readings were for charity. But at some point, I think in the 1850s, he decided, you know what? I need the income. I've got all these boys to raise in my house. And I'm going to do it. And let's see how it's received. And so he started performing publicly, selling tickets. And audiences accepted it. They thought it was fantastic. He toured all over the British Isles, and also came to America and toured.
Now, how did you first find out about Dickens' readings, Tom, and what inspired you to go ahead and do your own show, adapting Dickens' readings for the stage?
Well, I think I was reading an article about how Dickens was so influential in our modern thinking of what Christmas is, but because before Dickens, Christmas was a very different holiday, and it was really Dickens who created the kind of Christmas that we think of with, you know, a turkey and with exchanging presents. That was being invented by Victorian England, and Dickens had a large part in that, and also of the idea that one is kind to those less fortunate, especially at the holidays. That was a new idea. And of course, he was very socially active in his writings and famous for that. And so I that's when I first found out about it. But I was really inspired to do a one-man show. I'd always wanted to have a one-man show. And I was fortunate enough when I was writing and producing to work with Hal Holbrook for
Mark Twain, yes.
3 years, who, of course, yes, is known for his Mark Twain. And Hal was really an inspiration. I grew up seeing his Twain whenever I could. And so it was not only a thrill to work with him, but he was an inspiration to just go ahead and do this, and that's what I decided to do. Curiously enough, Dickens, when he did his readings, he created his own version of his Carol, and he left out a lot of the parts that we think of as important in the telling of the tale, because Dickens was still writing, so he felt that his social commentary should be left to his pen. And he wanted the more festive elements of A Christmas Carol to be in his public readings and the social commentary to be pulled way back. Now, of course, to our modern ears, it would be unthinkable to see Christmas Carol without the idea of ignorance and want and all of the redemption story that we find so appealing. So in my adaptation of his readings, I excised some of the things that would kind of mystify modern audiences about figgy puddings and things like that, that delighted Victorians, so that there was room to put back some of that social commentary that modern audiences would find so necessary for the telling of the tale.
And your first performance, from what I could see on the internet, was it 2004, Tom?
Yes. I had received a grant from RAC to perform some readings at the old church, and I did a bunch of short story readings, and one of them was an adaptation. That's when I kind of tried on the idea of taking Dickens readings and adapting them, and it was just an afternoon at the church, and I think it was an abridged version of what I do now. And it was back in 2004, and I think I really got going with it at about 2006 when I got into costume and did it as a full event as Dickens. And of course the church really helped me, the old church. I know your audience is familiar with that venue because it's itself a kind of late Victorian piece of architecture. And I've done it there in the First Congregational Church as well. And they're both absolutely beautiful pieces of architecture, and it does half the work for me because it's like stepping in a time machine.
Yes, very Dickensian.
Which is kind of the idea that I want my audiences to have, which is to be able to imagine that they're experiencing this. Now this year when I stream it, I really had to rethink what that is, because of course I can't have that architecture. I'm not streaming it from that facility. So I really kind of went back to those original readings that I was talking about, where Dickens was doing them around a fire for his friends. And it's a much more intimate telling because, of course, there's a camera, 2 feet from my face. And so it really goes back to that original spirit of, Dickens, when he used to perform in a hall, would introduce the piece by saying, I want you to imagine by a great stretch of the imagination that this is a small social party assembled to hear a tale told around the Christmas fire. So that was really his intention, even when he was in a big hall. And so this affords me the opportunity to kind of try that on and see if I can pull it off. So it'll be fun.
Now, I read, this goes back to 2005, Bob Hicks in The Oregonian wrote about your show that year. Glowing review, no ghostly apparitions floating down from the fly space or up from a trap door, no street scene crowds or wooden crutches, just a room, a text, a voice, and the audience's imagination, which seems like that would translate to live stream better than most theater productions. What are you going to do? You mentioned, of course, the mic's right in front of you. You'll have a green screen behind you and you'll be projecting certain scenes, or how will it work?
Yes. I'm trying to keep it simple, around a fire. There are some other elements that, some surprise elements just for fun. I mean, Dickens wrote it as a ghost story. I mean, many people don't know that A Christmas Carol is a Victorian ghost story, and that there was a great tradition of Christmas stories that were ghost stories. So, the fact that, he's visited by ghosts, spirits, is a large part of the telling of the tale. So there are a few effects that I put in just so that it's not a talking head and they're just for fun. I think they're in the spirit of what, you know, Dickens was a fan of Victorian melodrama. And, you know, the stage things that he did, that he acted in, were melodramas. So there is a certain melodramatic air to A Christmas Carol. He wrote it quickly. He said that because it was so condensed, because it was to be released not as a chapter novel like he usually wrote, where he wrote in chapters and released them, you know, like a month. Serials. It was all at once. And so he couldn't develop it the way he would have developed a novel. And I think that both acts in it, you know, that acts to its benefit, I think, because it really is. There's a shorthand to it. People understand it. Oh, here's a ghost. Here's a mean, you know, crackety guy. Here's poor Tiny Tim. I mean, all these characters are familiar to us because we know the story, but I think they were immediately recognizable to a Victorian audience. And that's part of its charm, is that its simplicity. But, you know, in its economy of words, Dickens chooses words extremely carefully. And I think that, you know, it's a magnificent piece of writing. And so even in his adaptation, because he cut his own book down and he added things to perform with that were better for an actor to perform. So he had that instinct. So he even wrote in the margins of his reading copy, you know, things to add and pauses to make and the way to inflect his voice. And all of that has survived, and all of that formed the basis for my performance off of his reading text. So so that's generally what it'll be. It'll be, you know, what simple effects I can do, and you know, and hopefully get out of the way so that the words can shine through and the story can shine through. Because you're right, it does adapt itself to streaming well, because it's really sitting around a fire and telling a story.
And of course, old time radio was just basically you, the voices, the sounds, and your imagination. And yeah, that's what we'll get here, right, with a little video accompaniment, you know, you as Dickens and several effects and scenes. Particularly interested in that, Tom, your description of its lasting charm because of your own experience as a writer for television, teacher of TV, screenwriting at the university level. And you did a podcast called Scripted, which talks about story and writing screenplays. So it seems that you've kind of found in Dickens somebody who would succeed very well today as a television writer.
Oh, absolutely, Kent. I mean, I tell my students that all the time. If a TV is the popular literature of its time, which is now, and that, you know, Dickens wrote serials, and what are serials but episodic television? So, you know, Dickens would have done very well with his novels writing weekly episodes. I think he would, I have no doubt in my mind that Dickens would have been writing for television if he were a contemporary writer. None at all.
I have to agree with you. Now we mentioned, or you mentioned a little earlier about those enduring charms of Christmas Carol as a ghost story, but also as a story of redemption. To me, The fact that belief that bad people can be redeemed, even if the means of redemption are shame and terror through those ghosts, you know, is very comforting. Given the last 4 years in our country, I've thought about that many times, and it's something I think we'd all like to hold on to, but seems even more difficult to believe given the bad people around us today. Maybe it was no different during Dickens' time. What's the message you hope viewers will take away from your performance, especially for this holiday season?
It's kind of like the play Our Town, if you're familiar with that play, Thornton Wilder's play, which basically is life-affirming. I read somewhere that someone said a production of Our Town should be playing constantly so that when we need it, we can check in with it. And I think that's true of Christmas Carol. No matter what year it is or no matter what's going on, we need that. We need to be reminded that people are basically good and that given the opportunity, people can be redeemed. And I think that, you know, there's no better time to be reminded of that than the holidays, and certainly this holiday, you know, considering everything that's just happened and the fact that we're in the middle of this devastating pandemic. I think that we need some good cheer. And, you know, Dickens was a really fun guy from every, even his family. I mean, he had his problems, but, you know, personal problems, but everyone that knew him talked about what, how much fun he was to be. He was really a grown-up kid, and he delighted in the holidays. That was, and gave, you know, big parties, and, you know, dinner at Dickens' house for Christmas was an event that he would not miss. He loved playing games, and so he was just of good cheer. And I think that, you know, the combination of that, you know, good cheer and the message of redemption is just really important for us to remember. And so what better vehicle than his, you know, this story, which is just such a fantastic, and a fantastic story that none of us seem to ever tire of. I mean, at least I don't tire of it. I think it's worth the telling every year.
And as you say, maybe we need it this year more than ever.
Yes, very possibly.
Well, Tom, again, many thanks for joining us today, and I wish you a very Merry Christmas.
And you as well, and your listeners as well. Happy holidays. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. We've been talking with Tom Bray, who will be performing his Portland holiday tradition, A Christmas Carol, a Victorian Reading, this Saturday, December 19th at 7 p.m. The performance will be live streamed and also be available for viewing on demand up until December 26th, the day after Christmas. You can find out more online and purchase tickets if you'd like at pdxchristmas.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio.